Chapter 5, Deluge. My role at the 23rd annual Vanity Fair Oscar party was to assist Justin, the magazine's staff photographer. Thanks to my colleagues in the fashion department, I would wear a borrowed navy blue velvet A-line dress made by Valentino, with a draped neckline and thin straps that crisscrossed on my back. I couldn't wait. I was in Los Angeles on Sunday morning, the day of the event, sitting in the spa at the Montage Beverly Hills Hotel when I heard from Anna. Had a sauna this morning alone, she wrote, referring to the infrared spa we'd been to together. OMG, I just looked it up and you can buy the whole cabin for like $1,000. She sent a website link as proof. Amazing, I responded enthusiastically. I'm in the hotel sauna now. I didn't take Anna's discovery very seriously. She lived in a hotel. Where would she put a sauna? Then her next text arrived. I'll find out if I can put it in my hotel somewhere. It totally makes sense to buy your own. Laughing out loud as I shook my head, I read her message twice before responding. What was it she had said about unnecessary stuff? Haha, I wonder if they'll let you, I texted back. I'm just gonna order it and say, oh, I didn't realize it's that big. Asking for forgiveness, not permission, I knew that routine. But a $1,000 infrared sauna delivered to her hotel? I wasn't sure if she was kidding. Over time, I would learn that Anna often had ideas that sounded like jokes. She would laugh at them, too, before pushing them forward to see how far they could go. In this instance, her idea went all the way. 4 months later, 11 Howard would open a higher-dose location inside the hotel thanks to her suggestion. Anna's grandiosity, though sometimes confounding, had a tendency to work in her favor. I carried on with my day. I walked to a salon and had my hair styled into a loose braid that fell over my right shoulder. Then, back at the hotel, I joined a couple of my coworkers to have our makeup done by a professional. Alone in my room for the finishing touches, I squeezed into shapewear, strapped on my patent leather Marnie platform sandals with a 5-inch block heel, and finally slipped on my dress. Then came the tricky part. I sucked in and twisted around while attempting to fasten my zipper. Halfway up, it snagged. I battled with it for a few minutes, but already late, I was forced to give up. Vanity Fair's party would be held in a pavilion connected to the Wallace Annenberg Center for the Performing Arts. Arriving at 4:30, I shimmied past colleagues to keep my back hidden. Ryan was the first friend I saw. Help, I cheeped, then spun around, inhaled, and stuck out my elbows. He gave the zipper a yank, and it rose. Properly dressed and ready at last, I met Justin, and we got to work. The Oscars ceremony ended with a colossal snafu, an envelope mix-up that caused Faye Dunaway to mistakenly declare La La Land rather than Moonlight the year's best picture. The botched announcement resulted in an interrupted acceptance speech and a quick reversal that left more than 30 million television viewers cringing. By the time guests arrived to the Vanity Fair party, full of adrenaline following the drama they had just witnessed, they were most definitely ready for a drink. White-coated servers holding trays of Dom Perignon greeted them just inside the door. Movie stars, fashion icons, politicians, musicians, athletes, and moguls soon filled the room. The pages of the magazine came to life. My job was the real-life Hollywood edition of Where's Waldo? Spot the Oscars. They were in the hands of Emma Stone, Casey Affleck, Viola Davis, and Mahershala Ali, among others. I circled the room, scanning faces and nudging Justin when I saw a moment requiring a shot. The space became a dreamscape of celebrities. Mick Jagger, Scarlett Johansson, Matt Damon, Mary J. Blige, Tom Ford, Elon Musk, Jackie Chan, many of whom mingled in unexpected groupings like Amy Adams with Vin Diesel, Pharrell Williams with Charlize Theron and Salma Hayek, Johnny Ive with Katy Perry. By 2 a.m., the party was winding down. Here and there, a few people still lingered, clutching their Oscars, riding the jubilant wave of a night's victory all the way into morning. When the room was nearly empty, I took off my shoes and walked barefoot to the car service line. Back at the hotel, I fell immediately into bed and woke up hours later in a mess of bobby pins and fake eyelashes. Anna didn't ask me about the party. Aside from our conversation about the sauna, she texted only broad questions, such as, how is LA, or how is it going? I liked that she didn't pressure me to divulge any of the gossipy details of my occasionally glamorous work life. Instead, she focused on making plans together for when I got back. "I'm with Casey at 6:30 a.m. next week, Monday, Tuesday, Friday," she wrote. "You're welcome to join." Determined to elevate her fitness regimen, Anna had done research and discovered that celebrity fitness trainer Casey Duke had gotten Dakota Johnson in shape for her role in 50 Shades Darker. Unfazed by a private session's $300 price tag, Anna had begun working out with Casey while I was away. "I know you're only back Monday night," she said, "so come either Tuesday or Friday." "Amazing," I replied. "I think I'll probably be too exhausted on Tuesday, but would love to join on Friday." At first, I thought it would be a one-off, that I could join Anna for her session, which she was paying for regardless of my being there, and maybe learn a few exercises that I could repeat later on my own. But upon my return to New York, my friendship with Anna would intensify, and we would begin to see each other and Casey for workout sessions on an almost daily basis. Nick was still away, and our relationship was rocky. Coincidentally, I'd fallen out of touch with Ashley and Mariella while Anna had been abroad. Not for any particular reason, maybe just that during the winter I'd been feeling less social, wanting to stay in more than go out. Living in New York was like that, filled with phases. When you can have anything at any time, restaurants, bars, clubs, museums, theaters, on and on, in the city that never sleeps, sometimes you go all out and sometimes you stay all in. That Friday morning at 6, Anna texted to make sure I was awake. Our session was scheduled for 6:30, and the plan was for her to pick me up on the way to Casey's gym in Chelsea. It was Anna who had decided that we should work out so early in the morning, partially because that was the time Casey had available. Although she didn't have an office job like I did, Anna set lofty goals for herself when it came to kicking off her work days. That said, she often missed the mark, and as time went on, I would learn that Anna was constantly late, even if her intention to be an early riser was sincere. The morning air was frigid, so instead of waiting outside, I kept watch from a window in my go-to coffee shop at the end of my block. Anna was already late when she texted to say that her first car had canceled. By the time she pulled up at 7:10, I'd finished my coffee and a small bowl of oatmeal. We arrived to Casey's 45 minutes late. Casey's training sessions took place in a gym on the lower level of her luxury apartment building. Anna and I jumped out of the car and hurried inside with Anna leading the way. Ignoring the building's doorman, we cruised through an expansive lobby straight to the elevator. When the doors opened, Anna walked in as though the people stepping out didn't exist. Downstairs, the double doors leading to the gym required Casey's handprint for entry. Stuck on the outside, we were relieved to see a man approaching. When he pulled open the door, Anna waltzed through without giving him so much as a look. Trailing behind her, I quietly apologized, said thank you, and entered. Despite our tardiness, Casey met us with a smile. She was older than Anna and me, in her late 50s, although she looked much younger. She was in far better shape than either of us. "Come on, girls, it's time to get a move on," she said, which was a relief since I'd assumed we'd arrive too late for her to fit us in before her next client. Casey brushed off my apologies and promptly put us to work. We began with arm exercises. After sizing me up, Casey handed me a set of puny 2-pound free weights, the same size she'd given to Anna. "She's underestimating my strength," I thought to myself. Little did I know that after several rounds of small movements with the dumbbell in each hand, I would barely be able to lift my arms the following day. Next, we focused on our legs. Casey would demonstrate an exercise with impeccable form, then Anna would go through a set and I would follow. I tried not to watch as Anna did her exercises. She rushed through them lackadaisically, and if we made eye contact, both of us would laugh. The morning's penultimate exercise, a New York booty lift, Casey cackled, required us to assume a lunge position and then rock forward so that our rear ends rose into the air. Midway through my turn, just as I was getting the hang of it, Casey interrupted. "Rachel," she playfully jeered, "how am I supposed to see your butt get into shape when you're distracting me with those awful granny panty lines?" Anna and I burst out laughing. Anna booked 5 sessions with Casey for the second week in March. "You should come," she insisted. "Are you sure? I mean, it's your personal training session. I don't want to take up Casey's attention. It's your time." "I'm paying like $300 for each session, so it's kind of like I can do what I want with the time. Casey is like pretty chill. I mean, she's fine with it. And it's more fun if we do it together. It's a little boring to do all those things by myself." It was such a nice offer, and I was happy to accept. She and I went together on Sunday and again Tuesday through Friday. Every morning would begin with a "you up" text from Anna, Then I'd head down to the end of my block and get us coffee while I waited. Anna was always running behind schedule and seemed to have particular issues with car services. When drivers were assigned to her, they would frequently cancel. I attributed this to the rating that drivers give passengers after a trip ends. By then, I knew Anna well enough to understand and excuse her foibles, but to a driver, she was liable to appear late, demanding, and rude. She would never say, "Would you mind turning up the volume, please?" Instead, she'd say, "Can you turn it up?" or "Can you make it louder?" until the speakers crackled. Then she'd yank the plug and slam the car door without saying thank you. We'd ride to Chelsea with Anna's usual soundtrack playing loudly, jump-starting the morning with songs like Mask Off by Future or Actin' Crazy by Action Bronson. The music would continue in Casey's gym, where Anna would sync her phone to a Bluetooth speaker and carry it with her to each station. Casey's other clients, who were also using the gym, would eye us with annoyance when the volume got too loud, so Casey kept it in check. In fact, Casey was generally the perfect counterbalance to Anna and me as a unit. Where we were flighty, she was grounding. Where we were late, she was patient. Where we were scattered, she kept us on track. After wearing my workout pants for several days in a row, I upped my wardrobe game. Anna gave me a pair of leggings she'd ordered from Net-a-Porter and didn't like. They were cropped at her shins in an unflattering way, but since I was shorter, they came down almost to my ankles. With those, plus finds from a visit to TJ Maxx, my beloved discount store, my new activewear supply would last just long enough to maintain weekly visits to the laundromat. By this time, Anna and I were inseparable. The world was charmed when she was around. The normal rules didn't seem to apply. Her lifestyle was full of convenience, and its easy materialism was seductive. Our workouts frequently ended with a visit to the infrared sauna. We'd rush from Casey's to Higher Dose and then back to Le Cuckoo for a quick breakfast, rounding out Anna's self-prescribed formula for healthy living. We took turns paying for Higher Dose, not in a systematic way, just by whichever of us made the booking through an app. But when it came to workout sessions and Le Cuckoo, Anna insisted on covering the cost. "You work harder for your money than I ever have," she told me. In isolation, these mornings might have whipped us into shape were it not for our evenings. Anna would usually text me before I left work. "Want to stop by for a drink here after you're done?" she'd ask. And as March went on, two or three nights out of every week, I did. We'd begin in the library. Anna did most of the talking. She held court, having befriended the hotel's staff with me as trusted advisor and loyal confidant. As usual, she confided in me more than I confided in her, which made sense, considering the magnitude of her day-to-day dealings, negotiating multi-million-dollar investments, for example, compared to mine, booking hairstylists and makeup artists for a photo shoot. I listened with interest as she spoke about her meetings with individuals connected to the hospitality world, people like Richie Notar, a managing partner at Nobu, and Andre Balaz. She also spoke about her financial dealings, about meeting with a managing director named Spencer Garfield and a banker named Dennis Onabajo from Fortress Investment Group. "We need to plan a dinner so you can meet them," she said, which I found a bit unusual but also kind of sweet. As far as I could tell, Anna wasn't close with anyone in New York aside from me, so it made sense that she would want to share news of her accomplishments and connections. Over white wine and snapper ceviche in the library, Anna was chipper when she announced, "Fortress did all this KYC on me and I passed, so anyone who's thinking I'm not legit should just look at that." Anna had taught me that KYC was an acronym for Know Your Customer, a process through which a financial institution evaluates a potential client before doing business. Were Anna to have passed Fortress's KYC as she claimed, it meant that the firm had verified her identity, assessed her suitability, and evaluated potential risks to determine she was credible. The mere fact that Anna understood the hedge fund world was enough to impress me, let alone that she understood it well enough to navigate the paperwork and God knows what else necessary to satisfy potential investors. As for her concern that people might question her legitimacy, Anna was an oddball 26-year-old, half fashion, half foreign, and I mean that intrinsically, as in Anna had a quality that marked her as other, as outlandish, as strange. I completely understood why people would have doubts. She was like a fashion girl finance bro hybrid trapped in a Botticelli body. It was confusing, but the effect worked in her favor. The two of us made ourselves at home in the library. We drop our stuff onto a couch and then perch on the stools in front of the concierge desk to gossip with whomever was working. Not everyone found Anna amusing, but no one could deny she was ballsy. She had a directness that could be off-putting to some people and a sort of comical overconfidence that I found equal parts abhorrent and entertaining. She romped around with the demeanor of a spoiled, seldom-disciplined child, which was offset by her tendency to befriend workers rather than management, and to let slip the occasional comment suggesting a deeper empathy. It's a lot of responsibility to have people working for you. People have families to feed, that's no joke, she once said. It was reassuring to hear Anna make remarks of that nature, and she usually made them at just the right time, whenever I was finding it difficult to connect. One evening, I caught her giving herself a pep talk in the mirror next to the concierge desk in the library. I'm so pretty and rich, she bragged. We'd had a few glasses of wine, but even still, my jaw dropped. Who says that? Are you talking to yourself? I asked. Did you just say I'm so pretty and rich? She spun around toward me with a vulnerable smile and then, noting my dismay, doubled over with laughter. She took delight in my astonishment, as if she were a kid who'd said a cuss word and gleefully discovered it was naughty. I laughed, too, stupefied by her oddity. At times it felt like she was putting on a show. The girl who fell to earth. Grandiose, ingenious, one of a kind, and out of place. Her behavior often landed in the ambiguous space between sincerity and jest. I remember one evening when she called someone a peasant, either to his face or as he walked away, I can't recall, but she said it with a theatrical scoff. I was appalled. Did you just call someone a peasant? I asked her, distrusting my own ears. Again, she laughed at my shock, except this time I didn't join her. Oh, it's not offensive in Germany, she explained. Well, it's offensive here, I said. Now and then we would banter with other hotel guests. Friendly to a fault, I sometimes chatted with them for longer than Anna seemed to like. She was fast with her appraisals, deciding within minutes whether a person had anything to offer. Entertainment value, interesting conversation, and so on. If they didn't, she was liable to ignore them. Come to think of it, I can't recall Anna ever pretending to like someone or something she didn't. She was direct with her opinions, and she had them. Get out of here with that garbage, she might say, only half kidding, if someone offered her some French fries or some other random thing she didn't want. She also loved to refer to people and things as fake news. It might happen like this. Anna, no, it's so late, I need to go home. No, no, come back, Anna called to the waiter, laughing. Two more glasses, don't listen to Rachel, she's fake news. Anna knew where she stood on all things, even her non-opinions were delivered with certitude. For example, if you asked Anna about her politics, she would tell you that she was decidedly non-political. Politics had little to do with power, she professed. Money was the world's true governing force. Even when I disagreed with her or was embarrassed by her entitlement, she cut in front of people constantly. Anna's choosiness made me value her approval and feel privileged to be her friend. When it was only the two of us, Anna would tell me about her meetings and her frustration over delays with the lease for the church missions house. The Art Foundation was Anna's dream. She worked towards its actualization, but it was still in the conception phase, so I'd listen as she brainstormed. Anna had a way of describing the world, its systems, and power structures, so that anything seemed possible. In addition to the foundation's galleries, private members' club, restaurant, night lounge, juice bar, and German bakery, Anna wanted to curate experiential events that would blend art, food, and music. She mused about chefs she'd like to bring in. Having watched rapper Action Bronson's TV show Fuck That's Delicious, she eyed him in particular, artists she admired, and the contemporary art scene. She was savvy. And in the male-dominated world of bankers, lawyers, and investment professionals, she was unapologetically ambitious. I liked this about her. After drinks in the library, Anna and I would descend the spiral staircase, exit through 11 Howard's lobby, and walk around the corner to Le Cuckoo. Our first stop in the restaurant would be a nook to the left of the bar. You'd find us on a plush orange settee, drinking wine and distracting the bartender as he fashioned an occasional cocktail for other patrons awaiting their tables. The walls around us were covered with a hand-painted mural of a misty woodland. Its moody cool tones emphasized the romance of the warmly lit bar shelving and the room's crystal chandelier. For most people, dining there was no small or daily affair. In 2016, the restaurant was at its busiest, a destination for special occasions, with its reservations book always full. But Anna was a resident, like Eloise in the plaza, and if the library was her living room, Le Cuckoo was her kitchen. It was her choice location for meals, business meetings, and late-night shenanigans. Because she came so regularly, we received preferential treatment. We'd enter unannounced, and after a drink beside the bar, the maitre d', who knew both of us by name, would show us to our table. Anna, often wearing a Supreme brand hoodie, workout pants, and sneakers, would slide past the white tablecloth onto a mohair banquette embodying a lazy sort of luxury. Her flippancy, in attire and comportment, sent a message to those around us. Their big night out was her casual night in, except that instead of pizza, she ate buckwheat-fried Montauk eel to start, followed by the burrito. They were Anna's dishes of choice. She buddied up to the servers, the sommelier, and even the chef, Daniel Rose, who upon her request obligingly made off-the-menu bouillabaisse just for her. She drank pouilly fumé like it was water, and I did my best to keep up. The power dynamic in my relationship with Anna evolved in such a way that I was oblivious to its strangeness. The activities we did at the start of our friendship involved expenses that I could afford. The infrared sauna, for example, and the trainer we'd first booked through an app. Back then, when I committed to an activity, I assumed I'd pay my share. Anna would sometimes insist on paying for us both, but I'd return the favor on occasion. The only problem was that Anna's taste grew increasingly expensive. She started in the shallow end and swam out fast. She invested in her appearance as if it were a business expense. She went to Christian Zamora for $400 full eyelash extensions or $140 touch-ups here and there. She went to Marie Robinson Salon for $400 color and Sally Hirschberger for $200 cuts. She wanted to try everything. Cryotherapy, microcurrent facials, beauty-boosting IV drips, and on and on. When it came to material possessions, Anna was pared down. But when it came to indulgent experiences, she couldn't get enough. This predilection is what led Anna to Casey Duke and kept her going back to Le Cuckoo. And since Anna liked to have company, she pulled me into the deeper water with her, where I knew my way around, thanks to my job and past experiences with wealthy college friends, but was not capable of floating on my own. Anna knew this, yet wanting what she wanted, she set our course and kept me on her raft, and I let her. "What will it be this evening?" asked the server in Le Cuckoo. He held his palms together and inclined forward. He and I both looked to Anna, who ordered wine and hors d'oeuvres for the table. When it was time for me to order an entree, I turned from the waiter to Anna, seeking her blessing. It's not like she required me to ask permission. She'd have told me to get whatever I wanted. But I operated with an excess of civility. Because she was paying, I accepted my subservience and became increasingly deferential. I had not noticed that over time, the balance of our friendship had irreversibly changed. Part 2. Chapter 6. Hustle. The vacation was Anna's idea. She said she needed to leave the States again by mid-May in about a month's time in order to reset her ESTA visa. Instead of returning home to Cologne for boring countryside walks, she proposed we take a trip somewhere warm. It had been a long time since my last vacation, so after weighing her suggestion, I happily agreed, thinking we'd find off-season fares to the Dominican Republic or Turks and Caicos. I had already decided to spend some time traveling that spring, building in a few days' vacation around my planned trip to France, where I would join my colleagues for the opening of an exhibition of Annie Leibovitz photographs in Arles. So to factor in an additional week seemed doable. 30 minutes after sending her first text about taking a vacation, Anna sent another message asking, "Do you have a travel department at VF?" I responded to say that we used a travel agency. "Let me call you," she wrote back. Over the phone, Anna explained that she wanted to make a documentary film during the trip, and that she would be covering the cost of the hotel as part of a business expense. She wanted my help researching possible destinations, she said, so that we could make the most of the opportunity, since this trip out of the U.S. was something she needed to do regardless. After a brief back and forth contemplating other places, Anna suggested Marrakesh. She'd always wanted to go, and knowing that it was, in her words, the hot spot, she chose the Hotel La Mamounia, a 5-star luxury resort ranked among the best in the world. A Google search later, I agreed it looked incredible. 4 days after announcing that she wanted to go away, Anna reserved a $7,500 per night private riad and forwarded me the confirmation email. This did not seem preposterous. After all, Anna lived in one 5-star hotel after the other, whether she was on an island in Greece or in downtown Manhattan. And at the time, I fully expected to pay for my own flights and expenses. All that was left to decide was whom else to invite. Finding a videographer for the documentary became Anna's first priority. That's where Nefertari Davis came in. As a concierge at 11 Howard, Neff was an affable go-getter with a pretty smile and a penchant for gossip. Conveniently, she was also an aspiring filmmaker. Anna and I spent time with Neff when she was on duty and sometimes after her shift when she'd join us for dinner or drinks. She was 2 years younger than Anna, making her 5 years younger than me. Her interest in talent, fame, and money was overt. If she was starry-eyed about this or that person, especially anyone having to do with filmmaking, it wasn't a secret. She wore her passion on her sleeve. For reasons unknown, she called me Trachel, which stood for True Rachel, and I didn't mind. As the obvious videographer for the Morocco trip, Neff was on board from the start. She and Anna had researched hotels before Anna settled on La Mamounia, and the three of us texted about plans for the film and whom else to invite. Anna. The suite I booked has 3 bedrooms and can accommodate 6 people, assuming we all sleep 2 in each bed. Me. Okay, that sounds great. We should meet to talk about who else soon, right? Anna. Throw me your suggestions for 3 other people we can invite. We don't need to be 6, but we have the capacity. I will ask my guys who work for me, but most of them are married/have babies. Neff. I'm so down with it. I already have the people ready to cover my shift. Anna. Cool. Making a movie. Camera emojis. Need 3 more props that would fit the narrative. Neff. Ugh, I'm so excited. Director's clapboard emojis. Under New York State law, an occupant who resides in a hotel room for 30 consecutive days or longer is deemed a tenant rather than a guest, making him or her harder to evict. To avoid this, hotels usually set a maximum length of stay, after which guests are required to check out for at least 1 night. As a result, 11 Howard required this of Anna every time her stay approached the 30-day mark. She hated the inconvenience. Adherence to policies and procedures was her nemesis. She saw protocol enforcement as arbitrary. So in mid-April, when she'd been at the hotel for nearly 30 days, Anna came up with a solution. She made a reservation in my name at 11 Howard for 1 night. I'd check in and pick up a key as a formality, but all of Anna's stuff would remain in the room. She'd pack a bag and move to the Greenwich Hotel for 24 hours, where she and I could have dinner and a spa night. She would take care of the billing for everything. I didn't see anything wrong with this plan, so I went to 11 Howard around 5 p.m. on Tuesday, April 11, as instructed. Just as I entered the lobby, Anna walked by me without stopping. Had she not seen me? How could she have missed me? It was weird. But when Anna's eyes were fixed on an objective, it was like the rest of the world didn't exist. "Where'd you go?" I texted, confused by her sudden departure. Our massages were scheduled to begin in 1 hour. "I need to pick up some luggage," she replied, "back in 20. Neff checked me in. The process didn't take long. She gave me a key card, but with no reason to visit the room, I waited for Anna in the lobby and called the spa to say we'd be late. An hour later, 10 minutes after our appointment start time, Anna finally returned to the 11 Howard lobby. Again, she flew right by me, pausing only to grab the hotel key from my outstretched hand before schlepping her giant new Remova suitcase into the elevator. Because Anna was the one who'd made the spa appointments and would be the one paying, I was perfectly calm waiting for her to go upstairs and pack. Nevertheless, I was taken aback, and not for the first time, by her erratic and somewhat mysterious behavior. The front desk staff at the Greenwich Hotel expedited Anna's check-in. We flew through the lobby and took an elevator down to the spa. We were so late that the duration of our services was cut in half. Still, the spa visit was an extravagance and I was grateful to be there, especially since I'd been stressed lately, working through tension with Nick about the on and off status of our relationship, and also worried about my grandma Ruthie in South Carolina, who was in her 90s and had come down with pneumonia. Not that Anna knew it. I kept my sadness and anxiety to myself. After her shift, Neff joined us. While she and Anna chatted and laughed in the steam room, I stepped into the gym to take a call from Nick. When I found them in the changing room, Anna and Neff could tell that I'd been crying. Without asking for any details, they sweetly tried to cheer me up. Neff took the lead, telling me that I was too strong to cry over a guy and too nice to be in the wrong. Anna tried to comfort me too, but in a different way. "He must be stupid," she said, smiling, having pulled the word stupid from a song we often listened to while working out, "Got It Good" by Russ. It was rare for me to let anyone see that I was upset, so for it to happen now in front of Anna and Neff made me feel exposed. But their support made me feel closer to them, so I wasn't entirely sorry about it. By the time we got to dinner, I was feeling much better. We ate in the drawing room, a cozy den that was exclusively for guests, where we spoke about Neff and her boyfriend, a rapper she knew from growing up in the Washington, D.C. area, other staff at 11 Howard, and our plans for Morocco. With her interest in film, Neff studied every detail in the Greenwich Hotel as if it had been chosen by its owner, Robert De Niro himself. After dinner, I went home feeling excited about the vacation to come and happy to have Anna's and Neff's friendship. The trip was approaching, and Anna was determined to invite more guests. She asked me to suggest people, especially anyone who could help make the film alongside Neff. It struck me as odd that as the host, Anna wanted me to pick her guests, though I did work in the photo industry and her connections to that world seemed limited. I casually asked a few friends, people who could potentially take a week off for a trip, but I didn't push very hard. My hesitation was definite but undefined. Something just didn't feel right. Part of it was that Anna was so out there and I wasn't sure if my friends would understand her. Was I trying to protect her? Trying to protect them? Maybe both? Anna also appealed to a certain part of me, and not necessarily the best part. Because of her, I was often late for things, I drank too much, and I neglected my other friendships. I felt proud that Anna liked me, but was it possible, at the same time, to feel subconsciously ashamed? Feeling a need to reconnect with my family, I spent Easter weekend in Spartanburg, South Carolina, at my grandparents' house. My mom and I planted flowers in my grandmother's garden. We also picked a few, which we brought to Grandma Ruthie in the rehab center, where she was through the woods of pneumonia but still recovering. I also spent time with my grandpa Fletcher, went on a hike with my dad, and on Sunday dyed Easter eggs on the back porch with my siblings and cousins. It was a calming and uncomplicated break. It felt good to be surrounded by loved ones. Anna hung out with Neff while I was gone, which had become a bit of a pattern. Even though it felt like I saw Anna every day, I had traveled a fair amount throughout March and into April. I had gone to visit my sister Jenny in Baltimore, traveled to Stillwater, Minnesota for a bachelorette weekend, and been to Washington, D.C. for an engagement party. I'd also had a visit from my college roommate Kate, who'd come to the city for her wedding dress fitting. Neff later told me that Anna had seemed lonely while I was gone. I had noticed that Anna didn't seem to have many other friends, and I knew that she'd had a falling out with Mariella, and by extension Ashley, before leaving town in 2016. The details were blurry, something to do with Anna's lack of sensitivity. Apparently she'd called Mariella to deliver some upsetting news, but had relayed the message as though it were a fun piece of gossip. Even though the way Anna's friendship with Mariella and Ashley had ended made me wary, it didn't entirely surprise me, and I continued to give Anna the benefit of the doubt. Yes, she could be tone-deaf, I reasoned, and she lacked social graces, but she was well-intentioned. While I was in Spartanburg, Anna and Neff had dinner at Gramercy Tavern, went shopping at Rick Owens, and tried cryotherapy, an anti-aging beauty treatment that requires you to stand in a freezing cold chamber for 2 to 3 minutes. Anna bought a new pair of sandals during their outings, and she sent me a photo. "I think they're so you with their pearls," she texted. Over the weekend, Anna brought Neff to work out with Casey. During the session, Anna invited Casey to come along on the Morocco trip. When Anna told me that Casey had agreed, I was glad and felt relieved to have a genuine adult joining our ranks. "I'm getting so excited for our adventure," I replied. "Yes, we'll focus on the movie and working out," Anna said. My flight back to New York was early on Monday morning, and I landed to a text from Anna. "How about inviting Mark Seliger to Marrakesh?" she asked. Mark was a famous portrait photographer, also a friend and client of Casey's, but I knew him strictly through my job. I told Anna it would be too weird and awkward for me professionally. I believed she was serious about her film project, but asking Mark, an older man with whom I worked to come on a trip with four women to a private Moroccan villa? No. Would make sense, though, since he knows you and Casey and does film, Anna maintained. He's a very well-known/busy photographer, I replied. I'd be surprised if he were free. The conversation shifted and Mark's name wasn't brought up again. I told no one that Anna had even mentioned the idea. It felt too off base. It was clear to me that Anna was becoming increasingly vexed over her indecision about whom else to invite, and what had started out as a fun idea was turning into a more stressful project than I had expected. To make matters worse, by the end of April, Anna's friendship with Neff had become strained. Looking back, I can see that this was bound to happen, given the nature of their relationship. Anna expected Neff to be both employee and friend. At the same time, it was easy to see how, for Neff, it might have been hard to gauge the sincerity of Anna's offer. Here was this girl operating in extremes, party nights and power lunches, making bold proclamations and grand gestures. What was Neff supposed to take seriously? Despite Neff's enthusiasm, Anna told me, Neff was not getting back to her with the dates she was available for the trip, information that Anna needed in order to confirm her booking at La Mamounia, and the hotel's cancellation window, after which point Anna's deposit would become non-refundable, was approaching. Anna had given Neff a clear deadline and was annoyed that she'd had to follow up for an answer. When the dates were finally set, Neff tweeted, "I'm going to Morocco in a few weeks to direct a film. 2 years ago, I was a manager at Starbucks. You can't tell me God isn't real." In the comments section, Neff also responded to a person's congratulatory message by asking her if she'd like to come. When the girl said yes, Neff said she'd check to see if all PA positions had been filled. Anna sent me a screenshot. "That's a bit much, no?" Anna asked. I couldn't have agreed more. Part of my job on photo shoots had always been to make sure everyone respected our closed set policy. Social media wasn't allowed. It detracted from our collective mission, which was to make something great for the magazine to release. Travel, sets, locations, and talent were not booked so that a photographer, or anyone else for that matter, could take and instantaneously share shoot details or iPhone pictures that killed our exclusivity. It was a sore spot for me, which made my reaction uncharitable, especially since Neff did not have my experience with closed sets. "Considering I had to chase her to get vacation dates one day past the cancellation deadline," Anna continued. "Yeah, that's annoying," I said. "That's my problem with all these people," Anna complained. I interpreted her statement as a broad missive against people who were more talk than action. Anna also wished that Neff had waited to actually make the film before posting about it. "It would be so embarrassing for her if this trip doesn't happen," she wrote. "Then inviting randos from Twitter when you 100% know you aren't in a position to invite anyone. I mean, I like her in real life. She seems like she works hard. But this psychotic desire to show off is such a turnoff for me." She went on to say that she'd offered to pay for Neff's rental equipment. According to Anna, Neff had said that she'd go to the camera store to look at lenses, but it never happened. "I mean, what am I supposed to be doing that now?" Anna fumed. "I'm not the one who wants to be the filmmaker here. Plus, I have better things to do. I'm also not supposed to be chasing you when you are invited for a free vacation. You can't really have that attitude in any of the creative jobs." "You have to be scrappy, smart, and self-motivated," I agreed. "I guess she wants to come across as someone like this," Anna said, "but there are so many discrepancies between talk and action. It's hard to look past it. I get it, she has this job for money, but no one has it easy." On the evening of May 1st, I joined Anna for dinner at Le Cuckoo. Casey and her friend, who happened to be a Swedish pop star, joined us too. This was the dinner that Anna had actually made a reservation for. There was an air of expectancy in the room, and the waiters were preemptively giddy as they awaited news from the James Beard Awards in Chicago. When they got the call, a huge hurrah exploded from the kitchen. Le Cuckoo had been named the year's best new restaurant. The staff hugged each other, joined in a circle to applaud, pulled down the top-shelf alcohol, and toasted in celebration. By the evening's end, Anna and I were the only guests left, unofficially part of the family. It was one of those rare occasions that I experienced as if from above, swirling in ephemeral revelry. I knew then that it was special to be with these people, gathered by chance for this moment in time. In the back of my mind, I also knew that in less than 2 weeks, Anna and I would be in Morocco. This evening in the cuckoo reminded me that despite any misgivings, Anna had a magical way of looking to the horizon, understanding potential, and knowing exactly when to be where. Anna didn't dwell on her frustration with Neff, who removed the offending tweets as soon as she'd been asked. But exactly 1 week before the trip, Neff had a change in plans. It was the day before Anna was traveling to Omaha for the Berkshire Hathaway annual shareholders meeting. Anna had invited me to come with her for the weekend, but I was attending the 53rd annual SPD, Society of Publication Designers, awards gala with my colleagues from the magazine's photo and art departments on Friday, and an engagement party on Saturday. Neff sent a text to Anna, which Anna forwarded to me. If we were still going to Morocco, Neff said, she could be there only from Friday to Wednesday, not for a full week like the rest of us, because she needed to travel to Los Angeles for a video shoot with her boyfriend. Neff was going through a hard time in her relationship, so I wanted to cut her some slack. Anna did too at first, but the more she texted me, the angrier she sounded. She told Neff that it probably didn't make sense for her to come, since we would be arriving in Morocco on Saturday afternoon, and staying only until Wednesday didn't seem worth the expense. Neff backed out without offering an apology, and Anna was upset. The situation ended strangely. Since Anna was preoccupied chartering a private jet for her travel to Omaha, she asked me to speak with Neff to explain that her feelings, or was it pride, had been wounded. "It'd be great if you could call her tomorrow," Anna texted. "I feel like she doesn't understand how big of a deal it is." The trip aside, I knew that Anna was unlikely to handle such a conversation gracefully. Still, the triangulation was awkward. I spoke to Neff on Monday morning. While sympathetic to her situation, I did as I was bid. "To Anna, this trip was a big deal," I explained. "Even though she seems unbothered, she's actually pretty upset." "Anna's more sensitive than she seems," I said. Neff was lovely. She totally got it. And she promised to follow up with Anna to express her gratitude and regret. The conversation itself actually felt perfectly normal. I think I was the only one who experienced discomfort at having been thrust into the middle of tension between friends. To me, it felt like a scene from Mean Girls. Anna was Regina George, and I was her pawn. But there was something else about the situation that didn't feel right. When I hung up with Neff, I paused to reflect. It was something about Anna. The way she appeared neutral with Neff, even when angry. She had forwarded me their text exchange meant to show that she was annoyed. "Anna, it might not make sense for you to come out for 3 days. Neff, you have a point. Anna, so you're out? Neff, I guess so. Anna, okay, good luck with your shoot." In sharing the exchange with me, Anna was hoping I'd affirm that her messages to Neff came across as clearly hostile. But they didn't seem that way to me. If I were Neff looking at those messages without knowing that Anna was upset, I wouldn't have guessed it. Anna's words were too subtle to reflect the depth of her annoyance. Anna sent me Snapchat messages from Omaha, including a video of a rowdy, drunken visit she paid to the Henry Dorley Zoo and Aquarium in the company of some businessmen who were attending the shareholders' meeting. When she returned from the trip, she and I spoke on the phone. Our departure for Morocco was only days away. Now that Neff was out, Anna was struggling to find a replacement videographer. It seemed like she'd be happy with anyone who knew how to work a camera as long as we filled the space. Anna brought up the idea of inviting Nick. I asked him, but he declined, ostensibly because he was a still photographer and did not shoot video. This was true. It was also true, however, that he had become uncomfortable with the dynamics of my friendship with Anna. The last time I'd invited him to join Anna and me for dinner, he'd asked, "Where?" "At the Cuckoo," I told him. "Let's go somewhere else, maybe the Odeon," he suggested. "I don't think Anna will want to." "Why, doesn't she ever leave her hotel?" "Not really." "Don't you think that's weird? She chooses the restaurant, she chooses everything." By that point, I'd accepted the idea that because Anna paid for almost everything, she got to make all the choices, and I became defensive. I figured it was just the way some relationships were structured. I fended off his concerns, arguing that my friendship with Anna was real, and blaming anything he saw as weird as a harmless byproduct of her hard-to-explain character. Anna and I met up that evening for a drink and continued our conversation about who else to invite to Morocco. I was due to have dinner with a friend who was in town, but when it was time for me to leave, Anna was suddenly clingy. "I'd invite you, but I haven't seen my friend in forever," I explained. Jesse and I had become friends when he was working as a photo assistant and living in Brooklyn. He had subsequently bought a Winnebago and driven it across the country to Los Angeles, where he'd been living for the past couple of years. It had been a long time since we'd seen each other. Anna didn't take no for an answer, so minutes later, I sent Jesse a warning. I stopped by to say hi to my friend Anna, who lives in 11 Howard. She asked if she could walk over to grab a bite when I head over, and I felt awkward saying no. I told her I really want to catch up with you, as it's been forever. She should get the hint and not stay long. You'll like her, though. She's a bit crazy, but actually very sweet and fun. Love, crazy. All good, he wrote back. We met at a taco place called Tacombi in Nolita. Anna did not leave after grabbing a bite to eat like she'd promised. She stayed for the entire meal, and I let it happen. She and Jesse got along. Before I paid the check, without asking me, Anna invited him to Morocco. He accepted on the spot, granting Anna credibility based on her relationship with me. Apparently, my consent didn't matter to anyone. All around, it was viewed as either irrelevant or implied. This bothered me, but I couldn't think of a way around it. I didn't want to stand in the way of Jesse's free trip. I'd be glad to have him with me, nor did I want to complain about Anna's inclusiveness. I could only let it go. Having invited Casey and Jesse, Anna looked to me for insight about what they'd expect her to pay for, aside from the hotel, which, according to Anna, was already a done deal. Well, I explained, since you're essentially hiring each of them to do a job, they will expect you to cover their flights and expenses. Anna processed this information quietly before graciously offering, "And I'll pay for yours too," as though this had always been her plan. "Oh," I replied. "Thank you, Anna. You really don't need to. That's a very generous gift." "I'm happy to take care of it," she said. But the day before our departure, Anna had yet to book our flights. Her procrastination hardly surprised me. I'd seen Anna leave arrangements to the last minute time and again. Flights to Marrakesh weren't sold out, and Anna didn't care about getting a reasonable fare. Anna's trip, Anna's rules. If she wasn't worrying, why should I? She wanted to leave late in the evening, she said. She had a lot to wrap up before we left. This was fine by me. I had a lot to do, too. After Marrakesh, I'd be traveling on my own directly to the south of France. It was something I'd always wanted to do. When I studied abroad, I had planned to visit Provence in late spring, but when late spring arrived, I didn't want to leave Paris. So I put off the trip for later in life, and the time had finally come. It was a mad scramble to prepare for 2 weeks out of the office, probably even more so for Anna, since many of her meetings seemed to take place in person. I had played it cool when flights weren't booked earlier in the week, but on the day we were scheduled to leave, it was time to nudge things along. I wasn't the only anxious one. Casey and Jesse both sent me texts that morning. Jesse was heading to set to assist on a photo shoot during the day and needed time to get to the airport well in advance to park his Winnebago in long-term parking. I was the Anna whisperer, an involuntary intermediary. Aware of her characteristic aloofness, everyone texted me instead of her. I sent her a text at 8 a.m., "We could leave tomorrow if getting out today is too stressful. I do think people are slightly anxious about knowing the plan / flights being ticketed." Wanting to make the process as easy for her as possible, I looked up different flight options. Booking travel was a big part of my job, and since Anna struggled with logistics, I was happy to take on that responsibility. I took screenshots and sent her two itineraries that could work, one that evening and one the next day. What happened next is puzzling. Anna's moves were smooth and fast. She and I texted back and forth with various flights and thoughts on what was available. Then she found the perfect option, a TAP Air Portugal flight departing from JFK at 11:25 p.m. The departure was late enough that everyone would have time to get ready. Casey could pack, and Jesse could park his Winnebago. The itinerary involved a long layover in Lisbon, but what did it matter? We'd finally be on our way. "Looks good to me," I texted, followed by a few dancing girl emojis. "We'll need to change the pickup from the airport as well," she replied, confirming she'd take care of it. "Good call. I'm so excited," I said. Then, 5 minutes later, I received another text. "You busy?" Anna asked. "I can talk," I replied. "I get interrupted all the time and about to get into meeting. Could you finish our flights booking? Just one-way economy for everyone?" "With what card?" I inquired. She texted two images, the front and back of a J.P. Morgan debit card belonging to Anna Sorokin Delvey. "Okay, yes, I'm happy to help. Just forward me Casey and your info. I have Jesse's." She sent through a photo of Casey's passport and then a scan of her own. "They left out Delvey on my ESTA visa, so maybe just leave it out on the tickets as well. Billing is 11 Howard Street, 10013 New York." Her passport, issued in Durin, Germany, said Anna Sorokin Delvey, but I did as she asked. "Got it. Booking now," I told her. Funny that her billing address was the hotel where she'd been living, I thought to myself, but what else would it be? I guessed that's how it worked, living the way she did, full-time in a hotel. "Thanks, it kicks me off the site after 1 minute," she said. Right after I booked the one-way tickets using Anna's card, I received a phone call. It was a man from the travel agency telling me that Anna's card had been declined. Fair enough, the flight total was around $4,000 for the group, so I assumed she'd need to call her bank for authorization. He asked me to call him back once Anna approved the transaction, so I took down his number and messaged Anna. "Hi, Anna. Card was declined. Can you call your bank to authorize the charge?" "Will do," she replied. "Text me when done. Sorry for the hassle," I told her. "I'm on hold with the bank," she replied. "They say they will call me back once the block is lifted, and I need to raise my limits since Mamunia pre-authorized today as well." At this point in the conversation, it was exactly 1:45 in the afternoon. We'd been texting about travel since early in the morning. I was impatient, ready to get things sorted and move on with my day. That said, I have trouble in hindsight understanding why Anna's next text seemed plausible, but at the time it did. "Airline people calling me saying they are leaving in 10, she told me. I wasn't sure what to do with this information, but I felt the urgency. "Should I put on my card and you pay me back?" I asked. And that's how it started, the beginning of the end.